The United States withdraws from the INF Treaty, and violence continues in Hong Kong. What will happen next? Listen now on The New Diplomatist. Hello and welcome to the New Diplomatist podcast. Wherever you're listening, I hope you'll take a moment to subscribe and leave a rating and comment in whatever app you're using, whether it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, CastBox, wherever you listen to your podcasts, Google Podcasts, please leave us a review. Please click subscribe or favorite us with the star, whatever your platform prefers. And any comments or feedback that you have, I welcome that as well. Again, my name is Garrison Morado, and this is an unscripted foreign policy-oriented podcast that every week we'll discuss a couple, maybe three issues that are on the top of the headlines. We won't delve into encyclopedic detail, but we will cover what matters to you as a listener. Why should you care? That really is the ultimate goal of this podcast. But this week we'll start off by discussing the INF Treaty. The INF Treaty was originally signed in December of 1987 between President Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. It represented one of the most significant accomplishments to come out of the Reagan administration at the time, and also represented a major pivot point in Cold War relations and the conflict that had been raging on a silent level of threats and military arms buildup and the space race and other factors for the entire time from 1945 at the end of World War II all the way until 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The INF Treaty was a significant moment. It represented a toning down of one of the most hot-button issues at the time, the ability of nations to position medium-range missiles on the European continent and point them at their adversary undermined the principle of mutually assured destruction. Mutually assured destruction is the foundation of nuclear deterrence theory, and the idea is that a nation, Nation A, will not strike Nation B if they know that Nation B has nuclear weapons. The reason being, if Nation A fires nuclear weapons at Nation B, and Nation B gets wind of it, which they will, Nation B will turn around and fire nuclear weapons right back at Nation A, and both will be doomed to mutual destruction, hence making the whole idea of victory between nuclear powers non-existent, and hence calling into question, why would you even start a nuclear war to begin with? And this is what deterrence is all about. No nation who has nuclear power will use it on another nation with nuclear power because they know that they will both come out as losers. There's security in this. Well, the issue by the 1980s was that by positioning medium-range, fast-moving missiles on the European continent, one side or the other, whether NATO forces or the Soviet forces, could get the jump on the opposition. In this case, Nation A striking Nation B would be able to do so without enough warning for Nation B to respond, thereby providing a small but nonetheless a very real possibility that the nation who was striking first could win, could annihilate its opponent before its opponent had a chance to respond, because the distances were simply too short for there to be enough of a warning. It's not like a long arcing ICBM launch. It would be very short range, very quick, very devastating use of medium range missiles. This is first strike in nuclear deterrence theory, and it is the entire reason why the INF Treaty was so necessary. Neither the United States nor the Soviets could permit each other to gain the upper hand of a first strike capability on the European continent. And frankly, the Europeans, oftentimes caught in the middle between NATO forces on one side and Warsaw Pact forces on the other, did not want to become a nuclear shooting alley for medium-range missiles whose exact flight time and launch angles would put their cities as the prime targets. And so this does not mean that the negotiations were easy. I would encourage you to look them up. We don't have time to delve into all the historical significance, but needless to say, when the treaty was signed, it represented a major thaw in Cold War relations and helped set up the beginning of the end of the Cold War arms race itself and even the eventual reunification of Germany and liberation of the eastern half of the European continent, culminating with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Like any treaty, the bedrock of the INF Treaty was mutual verification, the ability to ensure that when the United States pledged to scrap all of its Pershing II nuclear missiles, and the Soviet Union pledged to scrap all of its SS-20 nuclear missiles, there, along with other missiles involved in the treaty, but those were the two main classes, when these two signatories pledged to eliminate those classes of missiles, there had to be a way to verify. And so much of the treaty was concerned with steps to be taken to ensure that neither side cheated the system. Unfortunately, in the 30-some-odd years that have intervened since the signing of that treaty, the United States has discovered various proofs that the Russians were violating the terms and spirit of the agreement, and this has led, in October of last year, 2018, Donald Trump to announce, as President of the United States, that he is withdrawing from the INF Treaty. He's withdrawing the United States, given the violations that he feels that Russia has made, and there is legitimate proof to this. However, it has set off a major debate inside the foreign policy community, not least of which because the president making the decision is controversial, to say the least, but also because it calls into question what should be done when a treaty is violated. That is the broader significance here. When a treaty in question is violated, what does America do? We saw a very similar discussion take place in regards to the Iranian nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action regarding Iran and its nuclear program. What did we do? We withdrew from the treaty when we found that they were violating the spirit and intent of it. And so that, while it does a good job of preventing the violator from getting away with violating the treaty, it does not succeed in producing some kind of outcome. As we can see with Iran, there is a uptick in tensions. There really is no proof that Iran's going to be stopped from gaining a nuclear weapon unless military force is applied. And so it creates a debate, right? Should we have stayed in the JCPOA and tried to somehow force them back to the negotiating table, tighten the treaty terms, or was it right to walk away? The same questions are being asked of the INF Treaty. Was it right to walk away from a treaty that was so long-standing with the Russians because there were violations? Should we have stayed in it and forced some sort of concessions from the Russians in order to bring them back to the table, tighten some of the oversight, or was the right thing to do to walk away? Well, in many respects, that's a hypothetical discussion, because yesterday, August 2nd, the United States walked away from the treaty. Of course, this was not well received in Russia, nor in the foreign policy community. However, there is legitimacy to this approach. But one of the major questions that has been raised by different publications, such as the National Interest and other publications, is whether or not this whole discussion of withdrawing from the INF Treaty really has something to do with Russia, or is there an X factor at work here? And I believe that there is. As the National Interest has noted, China actually plays a major role. Since China was not a major consideration in the INF Treaty's negotiations during the late 1980s, in fact, was not a signatory of the treaty, it is not and was not bound by the tenets of those missile class eliminations. So China has been producing the very kinds of missiles that have been banned by the INF Treaty for protection of what it sees as its national security interests in the South China Sea and along its borders, posing a significant threat to the nation of Taiwan, well, if you consider it a nation, or else the territory of Taiwan, as well as creating tremendous opportunity for the Chinese to create access denial to U.S. military and naval forces in the region, among other strategic considerations. So it can be argued that Donald Trump has removed the United States from the INF Treaty, not just because there were violations on the part of the Russians, but because America needs the legal breathing room necessary to pivot and maneuver a military-based response and arms buildup against the Chinese, given their actions in that region. So for future implications, keep an eye out, I would say, in regards to what does the United States do in the creation of new kinds of missiles and deploying those new forms of weapons in the Chinese Pacific theater. And what is the reaction of Russia now that there is no formal oversight to the creation of these intermediate missiles? Do tensions now increase on the European continent once more? Do we get back into the same reciprocal pattern of a standoff with two nations holding the proverbial guns at each other's heads at short range over European capitals? Do we get new intermediate range nuclear forces positioned on both sides of the Western Eastern Europe divide? History does repeat itself, and it will be interesting to see just how good it is at reruns. Another major news item this week, the continuation of violence and protests in Hong Kong today, with tens of thousands of protesters today, August 3rd, marching, some peaceably, many not peaceably, against Chinese intervention and rule in Hong Kong politics and Hong Kong law, government, and of course, the major concern being the seemingly apparent bias of the Hong Kong police and security forces in not prosecuting pro-Beijing gangs, but firmly prosecuting anti-Beijing protesters. And so that has sparked a tremendous amount of unrest in the recent days, coming on the heels of the original spark of all of this problem, which was, of course, the extradition bill. If you want to learn more about that, I encourage you to tune into last week's podcast on The New Diplomatist. But what happens now? The protests are only getting more violent, and they are only becoming more and more freedom-oriented. And by freedom-oriented, I mean the protesters are now demanding that Taiwan be liberated from the, excuse me, not Taiwan, that Hong Kong be liberated from the grip of Beijing, that they become a fully functioning democracy out from the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party. This is a significant development, and it is one that has asked many to consider, has caused many to consider and ask the question, will Beijing allow this to continue? If the Hong Kong police forces cannot maintain order on the island, will the People's Republic launch its PLA units to do the work for Hong Kong security? That will come to a head this week, and there's several reasons for that that we'll talk about briefly. Number one, Monday morning, there will be a considerable number of employees in various sectors of the Hong Kong economy who take part in a nonviolent strike. These strikes have the potential to be very damaging to the Hong Kong economy, and they're not without precedent. In the 1920s, there were significant strikes in the Hong Kong sectors of industry across the region when it was under British imperial rule, and the consequences of those actions was rather damaging to both sides in terms of the resulting crackdown and the harm to the local economy. That could, well, again, repeat itself as history this coming Monday, so keep an eye out on what happens there. Another interesting factor, as reported by the Asia Times, is that the Chinese billionaire, Guo Wengyu, who is something of a YouTube influencer, who has fled to the United States back in 2015, he stated yesterday, August 2nd, that he had information that China's central government, the Communist Party, would impose martial law and deploy the PLA army troops to Hong Kong on August 4th, which of course is Sunday, and at the time of this recording, that's tomorrow. That would represent a significant and influential change on the ground of the Hong Kong protests. In effect, it would result in a total decimation of the freedom movement on the ground, because those regular army units would not handle the situation with kid gloves. They would come in with an iron fist, and many pundits are considering the possibility of a second Tiananmen Square level massacre if things go south. Another major item to keep an eye on in the days ahead is the pending peace agreement potentially taking shape in its early stages between the United States and the Taliban in Afghanistan. This agreement would see a significant troop reduction on the part of the U.S. In exchange for the Taliban refusing any safe haven or cooperation with al-Qaeda. This is the crux of the entire war, and has been since it began in 2001 in the wake of the 9/11 terror attacks. Details at this point are still largely based on hypothesis on the part of foreign policy analysts and guesses by news media pundits, but we will monitor these negotiations as they continue to progress forward, with very significant implications for America's longest war, its longest active shooting war, which is now in its 18th year, And that is something that we'll watch very closely in the weeks and days to come. Other major items will include Boris Johnson losing another member of the Tory party to a Liberal Democrat in a special election. This means that a pro-Brexit seat is now flipped to a pro-Remain seat, and this will have tremendous implications for Boris Johnson's ability to maneuver and to negotiate with the European Union in his pursuit of a Brexit deal. And many pundits are already decrying that this is the end of British politics for the Tory party, that between Nigel Farage's Brexit party on the harsh Remain side and the consistent and growing support for Labour and Liberal Democrats to remain inside the European Union, or at the very least to force a very restrictive deal with the European Union on any Brexit, it just calls into question whether or not Britain can pull this off in the end, and whether or not Boris Johnson, given the very low confidence that the remainder of his government has in his leadership style, in his ability to unite the country, it calls into question his ability to negotiate and to bring about the Brexit that he desires by the end of October. And of course, there are rumblings of a breakup of the United Kingdom, which, of course, at this point is a bit far-fetched, but not entirely off the table, given the severe resistance in Scotland to the entire idea of leaving the European Union. That could lead Nicola Sturgeon and others to push for a second Scottish independence referendum. Also in Northern Ireland, there's significant resistance to the idea of a hard border reconstituting itself between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and that will not be acceptable to the Democratic Unionist Party that is in a confidence and supply agreement with Boris Johnson at this point in time. That will also play into restricting his hands in negotiating with the European Union, and of course, Welsh farmers also very resistant to the idea of a hard Brexit. All of these groups making their disapproval known to Boris Johnson as he's toured the United Kingdom this week, and that will continue to be a major factor in negotiations going forward. Can he, on the one hand, get the votes in Parliament with his reduced majority to pass any Brexit deal he might receive? And number two, can he maintain the unity and trust of the entire United Kingdom to make sure that Brexit does not just become an England-only exit, but actually taking the entire United Kingdom out of the European Union for good on successful economic footing? That is the question in the days and weeks ahead. Thank you so much for listening and for taking the time to join me today on the New Diplomatist podcast. Until next weekend, thank you very much.